I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Ben Swan. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Always great to see you and to talk to your wonderful community of radio listeners.
It's always great to see you, too. And we've been following a particular story, which is this Edgewood apparent dog hoarding case. A house was found with 48 dogs in it, which have become many more dogs because there were some pregnant dogs, and so there's a lot of puppies. And give us a quick reminder of what happened and where it's at now.
Sure, I'd love to. And frankly, it's a very big drain on the resource and on every single one of us because of so many animals that we had to deal with. The county based on some complaints, they executed a search warrant to a woman's house in Edgewood. That was April 1st. On April 2nd, we got 48 dogs. We weren't quite ready for it. We were ready for some. We knew there'd be some. We thought maybe 20. So luckily, we worked quickly with our partners around town and found some space for our regular dogs and got them into our system. Now, the thing about these dogs, and so it's been a long legal process where finally last Monday, the owner decided to relinquish custody of almost all but 10. The judge allowed her to keep 10, up to 10 if she wanted. And what does that mean? That means that she has to post bond on those animals to a tune of $20 a day per animal.
Wow.
So she, on Monday, she agreed, she selected 10, and she paid the county, I think, $7,000. And then she plans to pay about $6,000 a month until the trial is heard, which could be 6 to 9 months.
Good heavens.
Right. Imagine if we had to keep all 48 dogs for that long. It's been a logistical nightmare.
And you don't see that funding.
There's no funding, basically.
That goes to the court, yeah.
Well,
$7,000.
It goes to the county, and we have a contract with the county. And so we have a contract with the county, and so they do pay us a certain amount of money for each animal. But anyway, the idea of a whole of this indemnification is to sort of not put the burden on the public agencies or the private nonprofit agencies, but on the people who, this is something the legislature did a few years ago. They said, like, if you're involved in a animal cruelty case and the state, for whatever reason, has to seize animals, then you have to pay for their upkeep until the trial.
Yeah.
Now, you can just relinquish them, which is what we want. We want to be able to do what we can do with these animals as soon as possible. Obviously, if you want to have some animals for yourself and you feel like you're going to win your case, then that's a different story. But most people, especially people who understand about animal welfare, they know that any animal in a shelter system, it's just not a good place after a long period of time. With shelter is a great place, as we've always said, and we try to make it really nice, but it's not a substitute for a home. So we tried to work with her and her attorney to try to get her to relinquish the animals as soon as possible. Unfortunately, it took to her deadline to do it a little bit after there was an emergency hearing. But long story short, we now have legal custody of 33 of the dogs.
And some of those dogs have multiplied.
That's right. One of the stipulations with the court, because they're considered in our legal system property and somebody else's property, you can't really do much medically with them. You know, we vaccinated them for certain shelter things, but we couldn't really do x-rays. We couldn't, you know, if somebody was in imminent danger, we probably would have got a hearing or an order to do something with it. But we weren't able to examine these dogs or spay and neuter them, and 6 of them happened to be pregnant when they entered our system. One of them had puppies just a few days before she came into, before they were brought into the shelter. And those 6 puppies are doing great. The mom's really great, and so they're wonderful dogs. And these 6 other pregnant dogs had, now they have 41 puppies altogether.
Good,
so essentially doubled the amount of animals that we have. Oh, now, the judge ruled early on that any animals born at the shelter were the shelter property. So we'll be able to work with them and get them up to adoption as soon as possible. Some we'll have to take away from the moms because some of these animals are, most of these are under-socialized, timid, shy, very barky, and you just want to, so we can't handle them. Like the first dog that I talked about, the mom, we were able to handle her puppies. She was great. The puppies are just rambunctious and just sweet puppies. We'll have no trouble adopting those. Now, we want to make sure that all these other puppies that are born in the shelter will also be sweet and happy. And so we'll have to take them away from some of their moms after 3 weeks or so and bottle feed them and get them used to people and not be shy and timid. It's very difficult to adopt shy and timid animals out.
And they need to be socialized if they're going to be owned by human beings.
Right. And so last week we worked on spaying and neutering as many as we could. You know, some of the older puppies, they're about 3 to 4 months. They're ready to go. These are great. These are German Shepherd mixes, Heeler mixes. So they're all available for adoption. And a lot of the older adult dogs are also with a little bit of TLC. They're ready for adoption too. Some of them are going to, they're going to be require families that have patience and a loving heart. We are working with Santa Fe Tells Daycare and Dog Academy. They've agreed to help accelerate the socialization of these canines through their really great facility over there. And so we thank them for that. So essentially, we're urging people to come forward and adopt as many of these animals as we can, because these dogs have been in the shelter 6 to 7 weeks now. They need to get out to homes. So they, at first, they were very shy and timid. We worked with a lot of them. We were able to walk them and interact with them. And then they started breaking down a little bit. They're not used to being in kennels and crates and spots. And we can walk them, but they just need a bit more space. They're fine when they get out in the yard and run around. But, as I said, the shelter is a great place, but it's not home.
Right. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it's springtime.
So
it's a good time to get a puppy.
Right, a puppy or a project, really.
Or an adult dog that needs that little bit of extra tender, loving care.
Yeah, and some people like these shy and timid dogs more than rambunctious dog. These are dogs that, after a few weeks, they'll bond with you. They're not as gregarious. They're not as adventurous as other dogs. They'll probably stay at your side. They'll do a lot of different things that, people who might not want an active dog will do. Now, the puppies are going to be great. And also, some of these dogs are going to be fine, too. And really, all of them, most of them will be fine.
Well, not everybody is a hiker and a runner and people who love to be outdoors all the time. And I've been thinking about that. I mean, at this point in my life, I can't imagine not having a dog. But when I'm 75 years old, I'm not going to be able to have a Jack Russell Terrier that needs 17 hours of exercise a day.
A Jack Russell Terrier is a terror.
A Jack Russell Terrierist.
Yeah. No, they're great dogs, but it's right. That's what we do best. We match the dog with the person's lifestyle. I mean, our adoption counselors are incredible about that. And sometimes we make a mistake or so, or the dog is a little bit different than they expected. But, those kind of glitches happen. And we work with people to either try to modify a behavior if they need it, or, training them in some way, or just say, hey, try somebody else. We'll find the perfect match. Just give us another chance. And we really want these dogs, we call them the Edgewood 48. They've had a rough time. We want them to have a good time. We want them to be loved. I can't speak for the woman who owned the dogs. Maybe she offered love in a certain way. I don't know. I can't speak for that. I just know that they need attention and love.
I think it's not entirely unlike children. I mean, it's one thing to have an only child or two or three or four, or some people have 6 kids and they do a great job. But if you were to adopt 48 children of the same age, it would be pretty hard to give them all the love they need. And as we know, kids in orphanages really suffer, and it's very good when they get adopted by loving parents.
Exactly. And that's why we have limits on the amount of animals that we can have, that people, for one thing, I don't know if she had any help or anything like that, but keeping it several dogs. I have a multi-dog household. It's not easy.
A multi-dog household.
Yeah. I have 5 dogs. And so, you every day you got to go out and clean it up. You got to make sure they're happy. They all cuddle around me when I get home from work and spend some, they want quality time with me. And, sometimes I take one out by himself for a ride and the other ones. Anyway, it takes time.
Yeah.
So 48, can you imagine 48? And most of these dogs, as I understand it from the police reports, were inside the house in Edgewood. Only 5 or 6 were running around loose outside. So they, like I said, they're under-socialized, and they just need a bit of TLC, and they'll be great. So
Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Now let's talk about their health. I mean, another thing that the Santa Fe Animal Shelter has done is really bring some of these dogs back to health from serious conditions, and I guess a couple of the puppies died of parvo.
Right. Some of the, you know, in the shelter environment, we try to make it as safe as possible, but sometimes disease and things comes through. And two of the puppies did die of parvo, and some of the other puppies that were born in the shelter just didn't make it. They're just too young. So, but, you know, our point is that if our court system, if people had been really caring about these animals as much as they should have been, instead of thinking of them as objects, we would have been able to get these puppies homes right away, into foster homes. They would, you know, I don't know. But I'm sure there would have been a better outcome for some of these guys.
And another lesson, get your vaccinations, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. Especially around the changes of season, there's all kinds of diseases out there that dogs are susceptible to. So, yeah. Vaccinations are important, and spay and neuter is an important aspect of everything.
So people can come in now and meet these animals.
That's right. I'm putting them, as they become available for adoption, we're putting their faces on the website and on Facebook. So,
are you identifying them as this?
Yes.
Is from the Edgewood 48?
We call them the Edgewood 48, and I can tell you this, we have a special adoption fee for the Edgewood 48,
mm-hmm.
$48.
Aw.
The puppies, of course, are just the regular price because, like you said, they're just puppies.
Yeah. So often when you come here to the Santa Fe Baking Company, you bring pictures of the animals that are up for adoption. Do you have any cute little doggies for us?
Of course I do. I wanted to tell Mary Charlotte that, you know, I didn't bring photos of the Edgewood dogs just because they're not quite ready. And so, but I just encourage people to go to the Facebook site and like us and look at their faces and things like that. You'll love them. You can actually get a follow up on what we've been doing with them since then. Behavior stuff. And last week I did want to say that the community has been so incredibly supporting of us. They know that our resources are stretched thinly. They've been giving us hot dogs and kibbles and food enrichment toys and really things that make things easier for the existing dogs that are there and these Edgewood 48 dogs that they're going to be needing a lot of extra care. And we have been able to work with them. Our behavior specialist, Emily, she's worked with every single one of the dogs, and she says that some of them are really, they'll be fine. They'll be loving family dogs. They just need a little extra time. So, but I did bring
and
in...
And you've been doing surgeries on them. There's,
right.
There was a dog that had a
tumor.
Yeah.
Right. Like I said, we weren't allowed to do any kind of serious medical exam surgeries with them. And one has a benign tumor, we think. We're working on that. And hopefully she'll be great. I think some of these dogs are great, and some of them are just have issues. And I did want to point out a long-term dog named Ace. Ace is an amazing dog.
Ace is beautiful. Ace is a black and white Dogo Argentino.
He does
Staffordshire mix.
We've been working with him because he's a special dog. He loves people. And the counselor was telling me earlier that when we clean out the kennels, he goes into a special little yard, and he has this soccer ball that he entertains himself with the whole time. He pushes it around. He plays soccer by himself.
He's a Latin American soccer
star.
Yeah,
of course. He loves he loves to play soccer. And he's a very loving dog. He does have some, he doesn't like all dogs, so you have to bring, if you have another dog, you should bring him in to meet and greet.
Which you do anyway.
Yeah, you should anyway. But so he's another dog that, thanks to Santa Fe Tails, we're working on some more canine socialization with him. There, he was supposed to be evaluated, and so that really helps them. You know, it was interesting. I was talking to Joey and Hannah Padilla, who own Santa Fe Tails, just recently, and we're talking about how kids and dogs, we are treating them almost the same way. We're trying to isolate them, whereas we shouldn't be isolating them, because whatever kind of problems they have, it doesn't help by removing the problem. It helps by looking at the problem and trying to get time to overcome it. Like Joey was very clever in saying that, you know, a lot of people, they have a bad incident at the dog park, so they decide not to take their dog to the dog park. And that actually increases the chance of a dog-to-dog reaction. It was, he said, you know, sometimes with some of these dogs, it takes guts to do the right thing. You know,
people are frightened because if their dog was the one who acted out, they don't want to take him anymore. And
I'm in that
it's
same,
hard.
I have a dog who has become dog reactive, and I've worked with him, and I've tried three trainers, and he just wants to play, but you don't know that, and it's scary.
Yeah.
So, but the more exposure, the better it is, and that's what he was saying with children too. You know, we sort of isolate kids, and we don't let them go to play groups because they don't really like these people, and it's the same kind of thing. The behavior, it doesn't help it. Anyway.
I know. I mean, and you know, 25 years from now, if everybody's like that,
we'll be alienated. No wonder we have such a friction.
I can't
everywhere.
Even imagine there people will want to work in cubicles at
yeah,
home.
Exactly. Well, you know, our internet age does, you know, help to, you know, make that enhance that. But anyway, you know, socialization, getting out with people is good for people and dogs. So,
and then you've got a kitty.
I do have a kitty. Her name is Sky. Now, Sky is an incredibly beautiful cat.
Pure white.
It's pure white.
With blue eyes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, she had an allergic reaction to anesthesia and lost her sight.
Oh, my goodness.
So she's newly blind. So, she just needs a little, like many animals, they just need a little TLC. And she'll be fine. She needs to get used to her surroundings.
Yeah.
And I visit this cat often.
She'd just probably be a good indoor cat.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's very special. And she says, even in spite of her blindness, she's just a beautiful cat.
Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. They're on the web at sfhumanesociety.org. The phone number is
983-4309. And if you want to talk to adoptions about these dogs, it's extension 610. So 983-4309, extension 610.
And the Edgewood 48 and other dogs are both on Facebook and on the sfhumanesociety.org website.
That's correct.
And it's just great to have you, and we will continue to get updates from you.
Great seeing you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you very much.
I'd like now to welcome Felicity Brennan. She's Executive Director of the Santa Fe Watershed Association, and Marty Peel, who is the Adopt the River Coordinator for the Watershed Association. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. Hi.
It's good to be here. It's great to have you here. We're here to talk about one of the most important and under-talked about things in the universe, namely water. You are with the Santa Fe Watershed Association, and I thought maybe we could do a sort of semi-didactic learning experience here on the radio, starting with, okay, I turn on the tap, I get my water to make my tea. Where does that water come from?
Well, Santa Fe has four supplies of water. One of them is the Santa Fe River, which starts way up high in the mountains behind the ski basin and flows down into two reservoirs that are just near, just above the Randall Davie Audubon Center. And that water then is piped through a water treatment plant and into the pipes of everybody's taps and toilets. But that supply is only 40 to 45% of our water supply in a good wet to normal year.
Which is not this year.
This is not this year. So we also have groundwater supplies, and those are wells along the river that we draw water from the deep aquifer underneath the river. And then also there's a well supply called the Buckman Well Field, and we pump those wells. And then, of course, everybody's familiar with the Buckman Direct Diversion, which diverts water from the Rio Grande below Los Alamos Canyon and pipes water into our pipes there.
What is an aquifer?
Aquifer is a body of water that's deep underground. It refers to water that was pooled in a wetter time. It's not water that's being collected today. So when we draw from an aquifer, we're borrowing from the past.
And it never refills itself?
It does recharge, but very slowly, as surface water, if there is enough, percolates down through fissures in the rock and makes it all the way down to that deep pool.
So it's basically an aquifer is water that is in a deep, rocky, underground pool. So it's kind of like you would need a year of rain to get, a few inches of water back into an aquifer?
It depends on the aquifer. But it's a long, slow process.
Yeah, and often hundreds of feet down. So if you think about how it percolates down, it's very, very slow to recharge.
So when you drill a well, you're taking water out of an aquifer.
Right. Often, depending on the depth of the well. There are some surface water supplies that are closer to the surface, So it's sort of a layer of a cake, if you think about that, depending on the geology underneath the soil.
So if you dig a well that isn't all that deep, you're getting water from underground, but it's not an aquifer. What is it?
Let's back up and do a little distinction. A river can be a gaining river or a losing river. In the mountains where the river is collecting water from the hillsides, where there's a lot of moisture, the river is gaining water. When it gets out here into the flats of Santa Fe, the river becomes a losing river. So it's channeling water out from a wet part of the landscape, bringing it out here into the flats, and then the water is infiltrating from the riverbed into the ground and out laterally, sideways from the river.
And that's before we start taking anything out of it. You're talking about a natural state.
In a natural system, right. So when the river is running like it has been for the last 2 weeks, out there by Frenchie's Field, it's a losing river. So water is infiltrating into the sand and into the ground and into the cracks in the rocks and moving down and laterally away from the river corridor, and watering the roots of things like the cottonwoods, the elms, the willows that are along the river side. The deeper your river cuts down, the drier your landscape, your river banks are on either side. So that's one of the reasons why you want to keep a riverbed up. So when you,
what do you mean keep a riverbed
when
up?
You don't want a riverbed to cut down too deep into your landscape, because then the water you're delivering to your landscape is deep under those riverbanks and your riverbanks don't get water.
Under what circumstances does your river start to cut down?
Storm events will erode the riverbed, and so you'll see things like pipes that used to be buried. You'll see bridges that people didn't used to be able to drive under. You'll see bridges getting undercut. You'll see gabions, the rock baskets, get undercut, and the sediment gets carried further downstream.
And the banks become much steeper. So we're standing up on a bank, and the difference between a river flowing at the same level of the bank, or it's 30 feet down, it's 35 feet down, it's 40 feet down, it starts to cut down into the landscape. Because rivers, when they're running, they really move a lot of sediment and a lot of rock. And in a flashy storm event that we have here in August during Indian Market, specifically, it usually rains a lot during that, large volume of water that's flushing through the system really collapses those banks and takes a lot of sediment and keeps down cutting.
Now we want to make, just so that people can understand what this natural system is like before we get to the ways in which humans mess it all up, what you're saying, this stuff happens naturally.
Well, it does. The difference is that in a system where the people have messed it all up, for example, here in Santa Fe, we've straightened the river, whereas a natural river will meander like a snake through the landscape, and that helps slow it down, and it's closer to its banks, and the overflow floods into what we call the floodplain, a connected floodplain. So all of that gets slowed down naturally, and the plants are there to slow it down, and these natural curves help to reduce the amount of volume. But when you have a straight river the way we do, it's like a fire hose. So when you get a lot of storm water and things flushing into it, it increases the volume dramatically, so that by the time it's down to Frenchie's Field or something, there's massive amounts of water flowing through there and eating through as it goes.
Okay. So you have your river. It has water running through it, either too fast or the right speed. But in either case, you have water seeping from the river kind of sideways and down. And somebody might drill a well that taps into that, but it's not aquifer. So what do you call it?
Groundwater.
Groundwater. So groundwater and aquifer are slightly different.
You have surface water, groundwater's deeper, aquifers are much deeper.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And groundwater, is that embedded in rock also?
Groundwater is in your soil. It's in your sand, your clay, your silt, the stuff you dig up when you dig a house. It can seep through cracks in the rocks. That's how it would get down to the aquifer eventually. But usually we think of it as in the soils.
Okay, so in the city of Santa Fe, there are some wells, but most of the water that we get, I know I get city water because I got a bill every month, so the stuff that I take a shower in, is coming through pipes, and the pipes come from these four different sources that you were talking about: Buckman Well, Buckman Diversion, the Santa Fe River.
Wells and the river itself from the reservoirs, two reservoirs.
Okay.
Mary Charlotte, right now the city is resting its wells, so they're not pulling water from the wells along the river corridor or the Buckman wells. They're using the diversion from the Rio Grande and the river from the reservoirs.
Okay. So in a time of drought that we are clearly in, which is a little scary and it's very dry and everybody's got allergies and trees are dying of stress and we wonder whether or not to water our yards and things like that. How does that affect the water supply that we've been talking about?
Well, that's always an interesting question in Santa Fe because our water supply is directly connected to all of our other economics and the policies that the city has. It's really important that we're such a good population. We're so hip and we're so cool in Santa Fe, and we use less water almost than any per person residentially than any other city in the U.S., which is very wonderful. And yet we also have a policy where that saved water gets calculated and banked, and if there is enough reserve, then developers of small developments, 10 units or less, can come in and buy our banked water. So it's very tricky. So we save water and we're trying to reduce our consumption, but on the back end, that water can go away to make room for more water users. So it's a very tricky
Of the things, right, I mean, we have this law with the low flush toilets and we encourage people to turn off the water when they brush their teeth and all this kind of stuff. And I do all those things because I've been totally brainwashed by I do this because I feel like it's the right thing to do. But that water isn't going back into nature. It's not going into wildlife. It's not feeding the creatures who need water for their habitat. It's going to development.
Well, some of it. And actually, so here's the thing about Santa Fe. We collect the water in reservoirs. It goes into the pipes. It comes into our homes. We flush our toilets. We take our showers. All that water gets drained into pipes and goes out to the wastewater treatment plant. From the wastewater treatment plant, during the summer, that treated effluent goes out to water our parks. It goes out to water some golf courses. It goes out to water the equestrian park. And some of it goes back into the river, which actually is a natural system down through La Cienega and La Bajada and La Cieneguilla. And then some of that water gets diverted towards agricultural use down there. So actually, it does go back into the system. And I think that's one of the pieces people don't understand, is that it flushes down your drains, but it ends up back in the Santa Fe River, the stuff that doesn't go back into the parks and things. So we do make great use of that effluent, which is a really important part of recycling water.
By effluent, do we mean sewage?
We mean treated effluent. So it is sewage. All of what goes down your toilet and your shower drain and your dish water drain all goes into the pipes, goes to the sewage plant, and it goes through many, many levels of treatment and gets flushed back either to the river or into these other uses.
We're talking to Felicity Brennan and Marty Peel of the Santa Fe Watershed Association. Now, talk about the term hardening of the water supply. What does that mean?
When we do a better and better job of not, quote unquote, wasting water, we harden the water supply. We get down to a low rate of use. Like, for instance, the residential use of water in Santa Fe in 2012 was just under 60 gallons per person per day. But if you've turned off the water while you're brushing your teeth, if you're saving your rinse water when you're washing your dishes, if you're only taking a shower every other day, you are hardening the supply in the sense that you've picked the low-hanging fruit. It's harder and harder to carve away at the daily rate of use.
So basically, you've conserved as much as you can conserve and maintain some semblance of the middle-class lifestyle to which we are accustomed, and it's harder then to find water to conserve.
Right. So in two more years after another more prolonged drought, we're not going to have very many reserves to draw from. Exactly. So that's called hardening demand. We're draining the bank account, basically, by conserving and conserving. We're not going to have much more to conserve.
Now, when we think about a city like Santa Fe, a county like Santa Fe, we're a high desert environment, we're in a drought, that drought could go on. I mean, historically, we've had droughts that have gone on for a decade. In a time of climate change, we don't know how much longer than that it could go on. We could have a new normal, which is what in the past we would have called a drought, but it's no longer a drought, it's the norm. There will be a maximum number of people at some point that a city like this can support. Has anybody run the numbers?
Well, I think people are running the numbers, and it's not being made very public because we don't know exactly. It's really hard to say what that number will be, could be, because it's just all so unknown. But I think common sense dictates that we're going to have to be very cognizant of that. And in fact, Tom Udall, in a report that was issued a couple of weeks ago, made exactly that same declaration, that there isn't going to be enough fresh water in New Mexico to support the use and consumption of the population as we do use it now.
And what happens then?
That's a good question that I don't necessarily certainly have an answer to, and I don't know that anybody does.
So basically, I mean, the things that have been floated are ceasing development, which drives up the price of housing instantaneously and precipitously, water rationing, which nobody wants. You know, your water, you use it up on, you know, day 25 of the month and you've got 5 days with no water, or what? I mean, this is something that is a potential of I would guess a almost likely reality.
Yeah, and there are so many experts paying attention to this issue, and the city is paying attention to it, and the county, and the state of New Mexico, and the Office of the State Engineer. Everybody's really concerned about this in huge ways, and that was Buckman Diversion, Direct Diversion, was an answer in some sense to that, where we're bringing water from another river system up in Colorado, and we're bringing it down, and we're taking care of our needs by transporting water across diversion, across basins.
Which is what? They put a pipe into somewhere in the river?
In the San Juan River, San Juan Chama.
And you can you see the pipe? Is it on ground level?
You can see the diversion, yes. You can go and travel and go get a tour of the diversion up there, and then they pipe it into a couple of reservoirs, and they let that reservoir water out into the Rio Grande, and then the flows down the Rio Grande, and then we divert it off the Rio Grande and bring it into our watershed.
Does that mean somebody else who would otherwise be using it doesn't get to use it?
Well, it certainly means it's taking it away from that natural system, and that there, but those are rights that we had to that water from, I think, the 1950s. So it's happening all over the world. People divert across basins all over the world. And so it's not that it's an unusual thing. It's just that if you think ecologically, you're draining the San Juan River basin of water that it could be having to flow into the Colorado River water system.
There are two sets of people who need water. One is people, and the other is bird and deer and fish and all those other creature people, as I call them.
Right.
And are their needs considered when we talk about water policy?
Well, that's a new paradigm. That's sort of pioneering thinking and recognizing that not even just, you know, critter people, but all living things, all of life on the planet and in Santa Fe require water. And that often hasn't been considered. And historically, our laws around water have not considered the health of ecosystems and building resilience through ecosystem health. So no, they haven't been, and we're trying very hard. I mean, the rights of nature, the right of a river to its own water, the right to a tree to exist in its own, have its own right to live as a tree, those are not laws yet.
One of the things that's hard for us to visualize is what the water is doing underground, but also what it's doing for the soil. in the ground. And without healthy soils, you don't have healthy trees, and you don't have shade, and you don't have transpiration cooling, you know, the evaporation from the leaves cooling. So there are basic cycles that help support our lives here that are very hard for us to visualize because they're out of sight and out of mind too often.
Well, and that's another thing. It's like there's the issue of the right of nature, because those creatures and rivers deserve to exist just because they're there and they've always been there and they deserve to exist. But the other part of it is they deserve to exist because we need them. And that's understanding how it is that we are dependent on them is another part of this understanding. Talk about some of the ways in which we are dependent on healthy, watered, sufficiently watered ecosystems.
We could start with a real basic, that trees make oxygen. So in our ecosystem, in our biosphere, we need healthy trees to make oxygen and to absorb the CO2, for instance, that we're overcharging the atmosphere with.
Right.
They provide shade. How much would it cost if we had to provide our own shade? You could start talking in terms of air conditioning to start to answer that question. Animals provide food. Animals move mushrooms around that fertilize the soil. Animals move seed around. What would it cost if we had to do that ourselves? Grasses hold riverbanks and tree roots hold riverbanks in place. What would it cost if we had to do that with our hardscape? And could we do it effectively?
What's a hardscape?
Hardscape is concrete. It's the infrastructure, the things you put in place for landscaping.
And if you were trying to hold up a river with concrete, all these microorganisms and burrowing creatures and stuff would die or would not be able to live in that place.
Right, they wouldn't be getting the water, and you wouldn't have the water getting through to the neighboring soils to support the trees that could shade the river. If there were water in the river, that would change the temperature of the water and the species that could live. Rio Grande cutthroat trout like cold water. What we have is brown trout, which survive in warmer water in general. So
some people might say, well, we've got farms for our food, and we've got ranches for our cows, and we can get farmed fish that is shipped in and things like that. Who needs an ecosystem?
Well, here's a detail. A farmed fish is fed grain. Doesn't make as much omega-3s as a wild fish that's eating plankton in the ocean. A farmed chicken is fed grain. Its eggs and its meat don't have as much omega-3s as a chicken that's eating green grass. Same with the cattle. So there's health of our arteries that depends on animals that are eating green things that were grown by the sun.
Right, but those things aren't, well, so the fish are in natural ecosystems, ocean ecosystems or whatever.
A farmed fish isn't. So farmed salmon doesn't have the same omega-3s that a wild salmon does.
Right.
And it's like a big feedlot. Those fished salmon, there's lots of them. They're in overcrowded. They get fed food that we've grown on land as opposed to the wild food in the ocean system. They're very prone to disease because they are overcrowded. They're very unhealthy in many cases. So they're, and yeah, it's very similar to feedlot cattle where you've got too many animals in a very small space and it creates diseases.
Makes it very hard to produce organic food because the disease element is so much amped up, if that's important to you.
We're talking to Marty Peel and Felicity Brennan from the Santa Fe Watershed Association. Now, another thing, and I ask this question every time we have somebody on talking about water, and I can never quite get an answer that makes sense to me, and that is, in worldwide, in New Mexico, any place you go, 80 to 90% of the water that's used, fresh water that's used, is used for agriculture. So why should I take a shorter shower or turn off my faucet when I'm taking a brush, you know, toothbrushing and all that stuff? I mean, it seems like if I take very strong measures, I might end up saving 10 to 20% of my usage, which doesn't even amount to 1% of overall usage if everybody did it, which everybody isn't going to, and until their taps run dry. So why should household water use even be an issue at all?
Well, I think if you look at the Santa Fe watershed, which is the area that creates our water supply from which we draw other than the Transbasin diversion and the Buckman direct diversion. If you turn your water off and everybody else's, we don't have a whole lot of agriculture in this particular watershed. It's really happening down in La Cienega and La Cieneguilla, and that water comes from springs down there and also from the treated effluent. So in Santa Fe in particular, your water isn't really going to agriculture. Now, it might be going to people washing their cars or watering their gardens or their lawn or something like that, which you don't want. But I think you can think about every time you turn off the water tap, you're actually, that's less water that's going to be taken out of the reservoir or pumped from a well. So actually in Santa Fe, for the agricultural piece, that isn't a huge concern here.
Let me also talk about it in terms of accountability. There's been a lot of movement in the last few decades toward more local production and local consumption of goods and resources and energy. And if I'm not sure what power any individual has greater than how he or she lives his or her life and accepts responsibility for the consequences. So it has to start with us. We have to pay attention to what's going on our behalf in restaurants, in hotels, at public swimming pools, and so on. But there is no other place to start talking about water consumption than in our own behavior, where we buy our food from, where we get our energy from. Is it coal that takes so much water and puts mercury into the water in the Four Corners area? Or is it solar on our rooftops? Can we bring it in local? Can we be observing the effects of that consumption? And can we accept responsibility for those consequences?
And so what we're talking about in Santa Fe, so the Santa Fe watershed really doesn't supply a lot of water for agricultural use. And so let's say we all conserve and then we harden the water supply and then there's a little more development and then we conserve and then we harden it more and then there's a little more development and we still get to this breaking point. And it's still, I mean, conservation seems not to be the ultimate answer to this. I mean, there's pieces that have to do with growth and limits also.
Absolutely. There always are and there always have been, and our hope and trust in the public intelligence and our ability to act is that we in Santa Fe won't require that level of crisis in order to really cut back or make dramatic, draconian changes. But can we be forward thinking enough? Can we be forward enough with policies and talk reasonably about all of this? Nobody wants to hear the gloom and doom part of it, which I think we can avoid if we do become realistic about it. Here's an interesting point, though. When the city institutes water restrictions, they find that people actually use more water, because if you can only water your lawn on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you water it a lot more heavily than you would if you can water it a little bit every day. So there's certain behavioral responses that turn into hoarding. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So they were, because I asked them last year, why didn't we institute those kinds of water restrictions? And they said it shows. You know, they meter us, so they know what the behavioral patterns are.
Right.
It's fascinating. So there's so much. It comes down to what are we doing? What is our awareness around all of these things?
Well, then there's moronic restrictions, like you can't have a fountain. And they were finding somebody on Canyon Road who had a one-gallon fountain where 1 gallon of tap water was being recirculated in this little machine that was run by a battery.
Right.
And they were getting these ridiculous fines.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. It is. It's where can you have the most amount of impact with the decisions that you are making?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that is in the water cycle, if water evaporates, you know, it comes through the pipes, comes down to my home, I get to decide what to do with the water that's metered at my house. If it evaporates, it probably goes into the next watershed.
Mm-hmm.
If I run it through the pipes and flush it down the toilet and it goes through the city pipes to the wastewater treatment plant, it goes directly to the agriculture down at La Cienega and so on. So not only do we ask where does our water come from, but where does it go? And it's a fact that when you water grass and trees, they transpire. They put that water into the atmosphere, and it can blow into the next watershed. But that's where our water comes from. It leapfrogs from the Pacific Ocean or from the Gulf of Mexico through evapotranspiration and on the wind. That's through the plants that are evaporating and creating shade and cooling in the process. And it gets to our watershed by raining on us because it evaporated from another watershed. So the cycles are big and we share in that way. If we think too closely about keeping it all in the watershed, then we don't allow green plants to do their job.
So those water cycles that we saw in fifth grade science class, where you've got a big arrow on the ocean that goes up into the clouds, and then you've got arrows and the little raindrops coming down on you, there's this continual question that comes up, is there a finite amount of water? Is there a decrease? I mean, there is a finite amount of water on this planet, obviously, in oceans and freshwater. Is there a decreasing amount of freshwater, or does it really just keep cycling?
I would say maybe a good way to think about it is like dollar bills. Are there a finite number of dollar bills? Yes, until the Fed prints more. Do they circulate? Yes. The more they circulate in your local community, the more people feel like they have an income, the more people do have an income, the more people feel wealthy. So it's like that. Do you destroy the water when you use it, or do you cycle it? Can it be used again? Can you keep it high in the landscape so that as many beings in your watershed feel wealthy? Or are you polluting it in a way that cannot be restored? Some of our money goes out of city through Walmart or through whatever. Some of our water will go out of the watershed through evaporation. How high a quality can we maintain, how many beings can use it in the process, is a measure of how wealthy we are in terms of water.
It seems to me, I mean, what I've come to, and we haven't talked about how agricultural water is used and misused in Santa Fe, and that's in New Mexico, and that's a topic for another program because we've got to go in a moment, but the question of what people can and should do, I mean, okay, conserve water, we've talked about there's only limits to how important and effective that is. What else can we really do? I mean, is it just awareness? We've got thousands of people listening to this show right now. What should they do?
I would like people to lobby for a living river. And I want to back up a little bit and say, why is it not wasting? Why are we not wasting water if we let it flow down the river? What I want to say to that is, we are practicing sharing before we get to crisis. We are buffering our hardened water supply by keeping some water dedicated to a living river. It's water that we could tap into in emergency, but right now we want to share it with the other beings, and we want to have that bottom lower part of the river in Santa Fe look like the upper part of the watershed, with green things holding the banks together, providing shade and supporting soils.
And that upper part is beautiful, mostly because nobody can go there. And so there are all these wild turkeys and bobcats and squirrels and all kinds of beautiful creatures.
But Mary Charlotte, let's also talk about the part that's down to Paseo de Peralta or Guadalupe, has trees and green grass and more water getting that far down the system, so it actually continues to support the vegetation.
Felicity Brennan is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Watershed Association. Marty Peel is the Adopt the River Coordinator. And I just want to say quickly before we go that on Wednesday, May 22nd, is Whole Foods Day, and Whole Foods is giving 5% of their proceeds to the Santa Fe Watershed Association. That's fabulous. Go buy your gourmet olives.
And your Memorial Day supplies, your Memorial Day weekend supplies. Yes.
And June 1st is Community River Cleanup Day, and we'll have an announcement about that when the time comes. And then on the 29th of June, there is a rafting trip with the fabulous Jack Leffler and Bill Dubuis, two of the most consistent and committed conservationists and wildlife writers and environmental writers in the state of New Mexico. So lots of good stuff coming up. SantaFeWatershed.org. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you very much for having us.